Well, let's go this morning to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. This summer we have begun a series on this book of the Old Testament. Just finished up chapter 2 last week. And so we're jumping into a new development here. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And our text will actually go from verse 1 to verse 15, because all of that hangs together as a unit. You may or may not have looked at the calendar, but today is July 31. And it signals not only the end of a month, but the soon end of the summer. And what that means, of course, for many of us is that school is starting back up again in a couple of weeks. Whether you're a student or a teacher, you're probably not particularly looking forward to that at this moment. And probably there's some feeling like that all the adults have as they get into another cycle of another school year. Or with your vacation time all spent, what do you have to look forward to but a long stretch of months of work? And there's nothing you can do to stop that. One of the things that all of us have in common is not just that we have the same number of hours in a day, but that we are all bound by time and we're all bound by seasons. Some of those times we enjoy, some we don't. And some we even hate. And some we can't wait until they're over. But whether we like them or not, we really can't control them and we can't change them. The reality is that unless Jesus comes back before then, 8 o'clock is going to be here tomorrow morning, whether you want it to or not. And somebody says, yeah, but thankfully there's 5 o'clock to look forward to. And the response is, well, what's going to happen after that but another 8 o'clock of the next day? And for those of you starting in school, that is about ready to kick back in, and you say, well, I have Christmas break to look forward to. Yes, that'll be wonderful. But so is second semester coming down the pike, and on we go. We can mark the entirety of our lives this way, and moving out of maybe a school period, some of you are looking forward to young adulthood, with some exciting things and some changes and some new ventures. But as well, middle age is coming with all of its burdens and eventually old age with all of its debilitations. These are inevitable, irresistible realities for all human beings because we are bound by time. You say, why are you starting off the message this way? This is pretty depressing. Well, we are supposed to learn from our situation being bound to time, and that's actually what this passage is taking up for us. That is the question before us. What are we supposed to learn from the fact that we are kind of trapped in time, and these good times come, and these bad times replace them, and back and forth, on and on, until someday we pass away. Solomon is dealing here with the relationship that we have to time. And so the title of the message this morning is this, Knowing and Responding to My Times. Whatever length of time God gives me, as well as the different sorts of times that I go through, what do I need to understand about that? And what is the appropriate response to that? Knowing and responding to my times. That's not just the title, that's actually the outline, our 2 points as well. And from verse 1 down to verse 11, we are going to talk about knowing my times. As we consider what is being revealed here about our relationship to time, these realities that we cannot escape, a starting point for our navigating that whole experience in a way that would please God, in a way that is best for us. It's just understanding what's happening there. knowing it, recognizing what is taking place. And the first thought that really takes up most of this in this poem that goes from verse 1 to verse 8 is that my earthly times are thoroughly mixed. There is a great deal of variety. There is not just one thing that happens, not just one kind of thing, and not just one long string of enjoyable times. It is thoroughly mixed. My earthly times are thoroughly mixed. The chapter does begin with a poem that is exquisite in the original language. In fact, it's probably the best-known passage in Ecclesiastes. And you hear it read at different events, and there's a time for this, and there's a time for that, and there's a time for this, and there's a time for that, and God has made everything beautiful in its time. And usually it stops there, and it really leaves you hanging from the point that Solomon is making. There's just kind of this sort of tick-tock of a clock back and forth, and it ends with this kind of soothing statement. He's made everything beautiful in his time, and that's the end of it. Well, I think there is going to be ultimately some encouraging type truth here, but that's not really the point, that you just be kind of soothed with that word beautiful at the end. What does he say as he begins? Here is the theme of the whole section, really, the way that he puts it at the beginning. Verse 1, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under the heavens. Notice that this is a very universal kind of statement, very broad. It's presented here as though there's no exceptions for everything and for every matter under the heaven. And that expression, under heaven, is parallel to the other phrase, under the sun. So he is describing life on earth, below the sun, below the heaven. That's why I'm speaking here of our earthly times being mixed. And he also uses, particularly in the first line, a word for time that we need to take note of. For everything, there is a season. And probably what comes to mind there is he's referring to summer and fall and winter and spring, the four seasons of the year. Well, those would be maybe illustrations of what we're talking about here, but the word is actually stronger than the word season. It's a word that means an appointed time. In fact, here recently we were reading through the book of Esther in our corporate readings, and we ran across this term when in Esther 9:27 it says, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days of Purim according to what was written and at the time appointed every year. In other words, there were set dates when that feast was observed. It was a fixed thing. It was something predetermined. And that's what Solomon is saying here. There are these appointed times. They are fixed. It's not some vague, just kind of whatever happens in some sort of haphazard order in your life. There is an order to this, actually. It isn't random. It is a part of a devised plan. And as he fleshes out that truth, what he's going to give us in the rest of the poem are actually 14 pairs of opposite experiences or circumstances. And in some cases, we have a little trouble identifying precisely what he's talking about. But we don't need to be bothered by that because the overall point is very clear. With these opposites, what he's doing is he's using a figure of speech known as merismus, where you have two ideas that are the opposite of each other that you want to think of in terms of bookends, and that are encompassing everything in between. It's like when we say everything from A to Z. We're not just talking about A and Z. We're talking about the whole alphabet over the full spectrum of these kinds of experiences. That's what he is getting at with this list. These are all ways of talking about the full scope of human experience. And there are 14 pairs. I don't get into numerology too much, but there are cases where in Scripture, some numbers are used on purpose, and probably the most agreed upon number would be the number 7 that is associated with the idea of completeness. And here Solomon is using two groups of 7, 14, as if to suggest this is the fullness of it. This is the totality of it. And everything else that I don't mention is included in this long list of things. What do you find when you look at the list? What you find in this comprehensive survey is a great variety of experiences. And some things are pleasant, some things are great, some things are fun, some things are enjoyable, other things are painful. They are unpleasant, they are frustrating, they are painful. And it is not that every individual is going to experience every last thing in this list. But again, the overall point is the idea, and that is that you can expect your life to be filled with a mixture of events, some of which you consider enjoyable and some of which you don't particularly enjoy. Now, I worked through this list and I tried to find some kind of neat outline and some kind of progression of thought from example to example. I didn't find one, and commentators didn't either. And I think that suggests another point that is being made here, that even though there is a plan and there is a determined order, even though we understand that these things don't happen at random, on the other hand, from our viewpoint, this list really does defy a neat analysis. And that is very true to life. And that is one of the conclusions that Solomon is going to draw eventually. That you and I, for all of our study and all of our analysis, for all of our efforts to understand how things take place or why they all take place or how they all fit together, it is going to overwhelm us. We do not have the capacity to analyze them at any depth. And so instead of making up an outline, we're just going to go through these one by one. The first pair of extremes, the first pair of opposites, I think, is given first for a reason, and that's because it summarizes all of life. He says there is a time to be born, which more literally says there's a time to give birth. Either way, it's talking about the outset of a life, and as well, on the other extreme, a time to die. Now, when you go on to these other items, what you're going to find is that most of the pairs are in some way related to choices that you and I make. And even though there is this kind of huge plan that we don't totally understand, as we're actually going through it, most of the time we are making conscious choices that lead to one or the other. However, at the beginning, he brings up this issue of birth and death, I think partially to make the point, you know what, when you're thinking about all this, even though for some of them, for a lot of them, there's a role for human choice is not the ultimate determining factor. You and I have absolutely nothing to do with the timing of these two events or the circumstances connected with them, when we're born and when we die. This is something that is determined by a higher power. Has that reality ever really struck you? You didn't have a choice as to what family you were born in or what country or what circumstances or what period of time. And as well, death is going to overtake you. And these things are ultimately beyond your control. Solomon begins the list by emphasizing how powerless we ultimately are, and that something or someone else is actually overseeing all of these details. Even though our wills to some extent may be involved in them, that's not the main point. And what it's going to suggest for us is that as we try to apply a passage like this, somebody might preach a message from a passage like this and say, well, you got this time, you got that time, and so the point is you got to be wise about how you use your time and not waste time and make good decisions and turn it into a sort of a time management kind of sermon. There are other verses that relate to that. That's not really the point of this passage. The point of this passage is who is in charge of all of this, and am I rightly related to the one who is ordering all of these circumstances in my life. And then he goes on there in verse 2 that there is a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Maybe he is referring to the actual cycle of agriculture that farmers would have to follow. And again, it's true that farmers are having to think through things and make plans, and they have to work hard. They have to plant the seed. They have to prepare the ground first. They have to water it. They have to take care of it. They have to go back through and harvest it. There's a lot of human activity involved. But for a farmer, for as hard as he works, he does not get to determine the appropriate time for when things ought to be planted and when things are harvested. He may try to follow some other schedule. And of course, in our day, we have sort of artificial means whereby we might manipulate nature a little bit to our advantage. But there are certain fixed cycles of the climate and certain elements of the process that God has determined that we have no control of. And that if we don't abide by those, we are not going to end up harvesting. These things are beyond our control for as much as we are involved in the process. Now, he may just be talking about farming, and that would certainly contribute to his point. But since this follows up in the same breath almost on birth and death, he may be picturing our lives in that same vein. That it's as though we are like seeds that pop up out of the ground at some point, and we live a certain period of time, and at some other period, we are like crops that are being acted upon and that are being removed and taken away. Verse 3 says that there is a time to kill and a time to heal. And let me point out, just as I've said, that many of these things are associated with human actions. For an item to appear in this list does not necessarily speak to whether that action or that decision is good morally. It's not a statement about whether you should or shouldn't do it. It's not prescriptive. It's just descriptive of the kinds of things that tend to happen. So when he says there's a time to kill and a time to heal, it's not this kind of, you know, wide open permission to take somebody's life. However, as you think about even those statements, the reality is that according to the Word of God, there are times when God wants killing to happen, as well as time when he wants healing to happen. You read the Old Testament, you find out that there is, for example, the capital punishment laid down as consequence for murder. There are wars that God himself commands and lives that he at certain times orders to be taken away for purposes of judgment especially. And there's a whole theology of just war that people have developed on the basis of the principles of Scripture. However you look at that, the point is that God's plan includes both the taking of life in some cases, as well as the reparation, the healing of life. And we would have to say, even when the taking of life is not justified, when we speak, for example, of inappropriate killing, murder, when we speak, for example, even of suicide, we talked about our own death. From one standpoint, biblically, we have to argue against those things and issue these warnings and bring the full light of Scripture to bear to identify what is immoral, what is unethical. And yet, when you look throughout Scripture, you find that God is sovereign even over sin. And that somehow in the mystery of his plan, even men's evil choices are woven into that plan. Nothing catches him by surprise. Nothing frustrates him. And there is nothing that he somehow cannot deal with. He goes on to say in that verse, a time to break down and a time to build up. Maybe that is synonymous with the killing and the healing. And you can think of cases where there has been warfare and whole civilizations have been destroyed. And then those same people have come along and have been at work to rebuild that society. I remember speaking a number of times with Tom Anderson, Carol Musselman's father, who's with the Lord, of how he joined the military toward the end of the Second World War. And basically, instead of actually fighting, his task was to participate in the reconstruction of Japan. And he spent a number of months over there doing a lot of humanitarian work and providing for those people and helping them to rebuild after the dropping of the bombs. That sort of thing happens. There's a time to break down and a time to build up as well. And even if it's not in warfare, that happens all the time, just in cities and neighborhoods all over the place. There are times when buildings are destroyed once they deteriorate or once they outlive their usefulness, and they are demolished so that something better and something bigger and something more appropriate can be constructed. Nothing is fixed as far as buildings are concerned. And moving into verse 4, he begins to talk about our emotional responses to those kinds of events. There is a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. Here definitely is a reminder that the times in our lives are filled with events that happen to us, not events that we are doing. You and I don't typically decide whether something will make us cry or whether something will make us laugh. Those are our emotions in general, involuntary responses to certain types of circumstances that we just instinctively identify as good or bad, and the mourning and the weeping happen to us. They just overwhelm us, or the laughter and the dancing on the other hand. Verse 5 says that there's a time to cast away stones, and the opposite of that would be a time to gather stones together. And this is one of the challenging lines to interpret what it is that he is talking about. I read a little legend that the Jews apparently have that when God was creating the world, he sent out a particular angel with a bunch of rocks so that he would spread them out all over the world. And as he was making his way along, he tripped in Palestine and just kind of dropped them all there. If you've been to Israel, you know that there's a lot of rocks there. And it's very rough, hilly, rocky sort of place in certain locations. And so what is he talking about when he speaks about these stones? Well, it may be connected back to warfare. If we're looking for some kind of Old Testament example, there was a time when the people of Israel, 2 Kings chapter 3, were fighting with the Moabites. And the Lord said to them that as a part of their conquest, they were supposed to ruin every good piece of land with stones. In other words, here is this field, these fields that have been cleared of that stuff so that they could grow their crops, and part of taking over was throwing rocks and ruining it. And so it goes on to say, as it describes the conquest, they overthrew the cities, and on every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. Maybe that's what it's referring to, in which case the time to gather stones together would have to do with clearing the fields of stones and doing something more productive with the stones to build up, or something along those lines. Or maybe it's a more general statement regarding stones. Sometimes they are cleared away as though they are not valuable. They are just kind of in the way. And other times they are collected because they are valuable for some purpose, like setting up a building or something along those lines. And actually, this would all tie in well with the next line, which is applied to people. And it says, there is a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Our reactions to people and people's reactions to us, they vary so widely, so dramatically in some cases. And sometimes we understand why they're responding to us in a certain way, why they're embracing us or why they're not. But again, the point here isn't to identify, when is a good time to embrace and when is it not? That's not really designed to instruct you directly about that. It's simply to get you to realize, look, when it comes to personal relationships, life is characterized by this sort of back and forth. Some people are really going to like you. And some people are not going to respond so affectionately to you. And some people who at one point were embracing you, at other times they might refrain from embracing you. And you can't predict how it's going to be. You can't guarantee that you will always be warmly received. And then verse 6, a time to seek and a time to lose or to give up something as lost, a time to keep and a time to cast away. Somebody said that this verse legitimizes garage sales. And it's ironic, isn't it, that sometimes we spend a lot of money looking for something that seems to be such a solution to our problem or that's going to make us happy in some way. And, you know, a year or two later, it's just sitting in our garage or our attic and we want to get rid of it. And there's a time for both. That kind of thing happens. You know, I realized as well that this applies to even people. Not in the sense that we ought to be shoving people away, but there's going to be a time, for example, when you have been trying to reach somebody and you have made an effort and you're not necessarily giving up on them, but there is a time to just kind of hold off and just say, you know what, I've tried what I could do, and we're just going to leave this in the hands of God for a while and let Him work, and my seeking and my trying to get involved isn't doing a whole lot of good. There's a time for just surrendering and saying, you know what, this isn't really going anywhere, and we just need to wait and see what God will do. I think that happens on the human level as well as on the material level. And he goes on to say, verse 7, there's a time to tear and a time to sow, which is probably a reference to ancient customs that when people were really grieved, what did they do? But they tore their clothes to demonstrate that they were torn up by sorrow. And yet when the sorrow goes away, there is as well a time to sew those things back together. There's an appropriateness of dressing with this clothes repaired now to demonstrate my relief, my comfort. There is as well, Solomon says, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. Proverbs talks a lot about when it's a good idea to talk, when it's a good idea to be quiet. But as far as the quieting people down, it tends to do so when it's talking about the fool. He doesn't know when to shut his mouth. And the idea in Proverbs is that common sense generally is going to instruct you as to what circumstances call for silence and others for speech. The very nature of life is that certain things call for a comment and certain things you're better off just to be quiet. And this is part of the just reality of how life works. Verse 8 is a little challenging when it says there's a time to love and a time to hate. Because we think of hatred as something automatically sinful. Is there ever justification for actually hating? Well, at least if we understand hatred in the general sense of utter repudiation, there actually could be an appropriate time for hating as well as loving. Have you ever thought about this statement about the Lord? It says in Psalm 5:5 that the boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You, Lord, hate all evildoers. Again, we need to be careful not to take this further than what is intended here. He's not so much commenting on the morality of some of these responses, but he's saying, look, in life, that's what's going to happen. Whether or not they should or shouldn't, some people will hate you and other peoples will love you. You're going to face times of love and embrace. You're going to face times of rejection. And then the final statement, a time for war and a time for peace. I was struck by the fact that what happens in this line is different from pretty much everything else, because what it does is to put the negative part first, and it ends with the positive. Most of the other lines, it talks about the positive and then the negative. Here it puts the negative first, the time for war, and it ends with peace, which ends the poem with the word shalom. Perhaps that is pointing ahead to the eventual resolution and the peaceful settling down of all these tensions for the people of God. There is a little bit of hope there, I think, in that little switch and ending on that note. And yet, in the meantime, before all of that is resolved, what is it that we find? What are we to conclude from all of this? You might remember that one way I used to summarize chapter 2 is that, in a sense, God wants us to hate life and God wants us to love life. And that struck me when I was reading this list, that you've got a whole bunch of things on the one hand that you naturally love, and you got a whole bunch of things that you naturally hate, that you dislike, that you don't enjoy. That idea of hating and loving is being developed in terms of specific circumstances. And again, it's not, he hardly has to tell you this. I mean, you naturally find yourself disliking certain things. You're just going to go through life hating certain experiences. It's just the way it is. It's just the way life is in the fallen world. Other things you're going to enjoy. He's not condemning you necessarily for hating certain things or encouraging you to love things. He's just saying this is the way life is. You're all going to have seasons of life like this. And you and I do not have the ability to guarantee from one day to the next which it's going to be, what this time is going to be like, whether I'm going to enjoy that experience, whether that circumstance is going to go the way that I want it. And I certainly don't have the ability to remove the negative altogether from my life. My life, my earthly times, they're going to be thoroughly mixed. There's nothing I can do to change that. And that leads you into verse 9, which initially might seem out of place, because he brings up the question, verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil? Now, that question is basically the same one he started out the book with in chapter 1, verse 3. It's the same question that as he worked his way through chapter 1 and 2 and all these tests, he is answered again and again negatively. There is no profit in the sense of something of ultimate substance, of something that is eternal, that I get to keep and enjoy, that corresponds to my true nature as a being made in the image of God. There is nothing. So he goes through that list and he ends up with the same frustration here. What is the point? It is not just that my earthly times are thoroughly mixed, but that they are ultimately unsatisfying. There is no profit of the kind that he has been looking for in this book. This list of alternating good things and bad things, it leaves you in the same place that chapter 2 left you. It leaves you with the same sense of frustration. None of the good things in this list are going to totally satisfy you, for one, because there's always a bad thing corresponding to it that you're probably going to face as well. And it's like the bad sort of diminishes your enjoyment of the good. You can't guarantee that it's always going to be good. It's like one cancels out the other as you make your way through life. Nothing can guarantee that your life is a string of consistently happy experiences. It's going to have this other side that's always going to cast a shadow on the good. And you're going to find yourself saying, as far as earthly life is concerned, this can't be all that there is, because there's so many problems that are diminishing my enjoyment of the good things. Now, that reality moves you in the same spiritual direction as the other chapters, where it becomes an argument not to idolize life, not to expect more out of it than it can do for you, not to think it's going to bring you ultimate joy. But actually, as Solomon goes on in verses 10 and 11, he's going to move us forward to a more positive truth. There is a warning not to idolize these things because there are all these problems connected with life. But there's also a more positive truth. And so we come to this next thought, that my earthly times are divinely ordained. Look at what he says now in verse 10. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. And that word time in verse 11 is the same one that he has been using throughout chapter 3 in this poem. In other words, he is making a comment back on this whole list of times back and forth. My times are divinely ordained. As we ask how it is that those things happen and who's in control of them all and how is this all programmed into some plan, we are driven back to God as the one who is superintending all of my circumstances. Not only what happens in my life, but when it happens. These things might seem random to me, but the teaching is they are pieces of a divine master plan, and Solomon describes that plan with a word that is translated here, beautiful. Now, we ought to talk about that word, because typically in the Old Testament and in our language, beautiful refers to that which is attractive, which is pleasing to the eye, an aesthetic kind of beauty. But in the Old Testament, that term can also have a more general sense of something which is appropriate or fitting. In fact, in Ecclesiastes 5:18, our version translates the word fitting. It fits. It goes together here. It coheres. That is the idea that we're seeing in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11. Everything clicks together in God's plan, we might say. It all, not that it's all pleasant or that I think it's all pretty, but that in terms of the entirety of the plan, it all coheres as a unified whole. There is a design and a proportion and an intentionality to all of the varied experiences of life that is determined by a sovereign God. You might say this verse is like the Romans 8:28 of the Old Testament, where it's talking about all things working together for good for our ultimate Christ-likeness, for the ultimate glory of Christ. That's what this is saying without specifically mentioning Christ, but that it's all ordered by God to accomplish his purpose, and it actually all does fit together. And yet the verse doesn't stop there. It ends, verse 11 does, by giving us one other truth about our earthly times. And that is that although my times definitely are ordained by God, my earthly times are intentionally mysterious. They are intentionally mysterious. What have we seen about our earthly times? That they are thoroughly mixed, that they are ultimately unsatisfying, that they are divinely ordained, and now that they are intentionally mysterious. When he says, also God has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Now, some translators don't use the word eternity here, but I believe this is the right way to translate the Hebrew word nolam, particularly because in verse 14, the same term is translated forever. If you look at that verse, it says, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. And it's like back in verse 11, he's saying, God has put in your heart a sense of foreverness. What is he talking about there? That statement, eternity, it speaks to our awareness of eternity. Given that we are beings who are made in the image of God, there is something more to us than just matter. There is something deeper. There is something immortal. There is something eternal. And connected with that, a longing to enter fully into that and to understand the eternal master plan that our lives are a small part of. He's speaking here in this context, particularly about that, our sense that there is an eternal master plan that we were created to be part of. And our longing to fit into that and to know how we fit into that. That's what he means by saying God has put eternity into our hearts. And yet, he turns around and says that God has deliberately not given us enough information to connect the dots between our what sometimes seems like crazy experiences and this huge plan that encompasses all the way from the beginning to the end, the works of God, the eternal plan of God. And you can illustrate it this way. It'd be as though I handed you some 1,000-page novel and I said, now only read chapters 12 and 13. And jumping into those chapters, you could pick up on some characters and some events and start to piece things together. But if I take it away at that point and I don't let you read the beginning chapters and how it all gets resolved, you're going to be like, it's going to be very little. You're going to be confused. Okay? You need the whole picture to get the plot and the point of the whole thing. Or let's suppose that somebody, some artist, designed some massive tapestry that ran the whole breadth of Asheville Highway and the length of it from Heron Circle down here to Church Street. You can just imagine a piece of tapestry that took up all that space. And you're standing out here in front of the church looking down at that thing. And you find it understandable what you're looking at, but you really have no sense of what this is. You say, well, I'm going to get up on a chair. And I'm going to look at it and get more of the picture. Well, you're not going to be able to see much standing on a chair. You say, well, I'm going to get up on somebody's rooftop. And that's going to help you. But again, we're talking about a couple miles of the thing. How are you going to see it from somebody's rooftop? What you need is to get in a helicopter and go up several thousand feet. And then at that point, you'll be able to see what in the world this piece of artwork is. And this passage is saying that at least on earth, God is saying, you may not get in the helicopter. I am not going to give you the full picture. At this time, in the world as it is, I don't want you to know my works from the beginning to the end for all of your life. You're going to be in this little slice and very often struggling to understand what in the world is going on and why these different things happen to me. My times are intentionally mysterious. There was an anonymous poem that Corrie ten Boom enjoyed along these lines, going a little different direction with the tapestry, but she said, my life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colors he worketh steadily. Oft times he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unfold the canvas and reveal the reason why. For the dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in a pattern he has planned. God leaves a great many things intentionally mysterious. And you say, why? That seems so cruel. That seems so abusive. We try not to treat people that way. What in the world is God doing? Well, that's where we get into the final portion of our text. All of that so far has been knowing my times. And verses 12 to 15 are going to tell us about responding to my times. And here's the first thing Solomon tells you as far as how to deal with this issue. And it's going to be counterintuitive, but in the end, I think it'll make sense. You know what he says? He says the same thing he said back in chapter 2. Enjoy life. Enjoy life. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. That is a conclusion or an application of all of these mysteries in your life. And you know, basically what God is saying is, don't get so concerned about understanding it all. Just enjoy whatever good God has put in your hand. You're not going to be able to avoid the bad times. You're not going to understand a lot of it. Don't get so overwhelmed by that that you are missing the blessings of enjoyment that God actually has made available to you. Precisely because there is unavoidable suffering in the plan of God, we ought to enter fully into the enjoyable experiences. And I'm not going to develop this because we talked about it last week from chapter 2. It's a recurring refrain that we're going to see throughout this book, but let me just share two quick thoughts. You and I can be so concerned on finding God's will or knowing God's will or figuring out what He's doing or understanding what we ought to do in the future that we are blinded to what is happening in the moment and we are not entering fully into His blessing at this time. And we can go through whole seasons of life like this. I must say I've been guilty of this. Where it's like, this is such a pain and it's not what I wanted. And can't wait till it's over. And you're always thinking about tomorrow or the next time or when I'm past this stage or when I have this. All right. Life is hard enough the way it is. That's only making life harder by constantly wanting something better in the future. He's saying, look, don't worry about it. Accept these circumstances and look for a full enjoyment of what God has provided you at this time and during this season. And notice one other thought there that he adds to this, something that really wasn't an emphasis before, when he says in verse 12 that nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. That emphasis on do good is something new. That part of a proper enjoyment is the doing of good in and through that enjoyment. If we are abusing the pleasures, if we are selfish and greedy with them, if we are pursuing them outside the framework that God has laid down, that's actually going to hamper our enjoyment. True enjoyment is inseparably connected with the doing of good in those circumstances. And that brings us to the final and the main application. I respond to my times, first of all, by enjoying my life in the present, and number two, by fearing God. Verses 14 and 15. I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before Him. There's the main application. You and I are not going to be able to resist God's plan ultimately. We are already frustrated with circumstances enough. We are really going to be frustrated people if we go through life trying to resist God. My arm is too short to box with the sovereign of the universe. In fact, one reason that God has me sort of trapped in between time and eternity is so that I would recognize that I'm not the boss, that He is sovereign. He gives me enough problems and things in my life that I didn't want and I didn't do and I didn't intend to recognize that it's not about me, that I'm not the one who is in charge here. You know, what if life were just like, what if you took away half of the things in that list and all of life every day was just like happy, happy all the time? I mean, we already forget God enough. If we didn't have any problems, do you realize how pagan we would become? And isn't it true that most of the time what causes us to actually seek the Lord and fear Him and depend on Him and obey Him are the problems? That's what drives us to Him? Right? That's the point here. And what is meant by fearing Him is simply to take my place as a creature and recognize His role as the creator and the sovereign. We're going to talk later about fearing God and define it more fully because it's a big idea in this book. But here we could just say it has to do with, if I could put it this way, letting God be God, not trying to play that role myself. Living in the awareness that I am a created being, beholden to Him for everything, created for His purposes and not for mine. It is such an obvious truth, but it is so hard for us to admit. And that idea of God's sovereignty is driven home by this statement, finally, in verse 15, that which is already has been, that which is to be already has been. You remember back in chapter 1, he laid out all these repetitive cycles of things that kept going on and seemingly nothing accomplished, and it goes over and over throughout history. Well, here he's saying, actually, God is the originator and God is the supervisor of those repetitive cycles. And that seems to be what he has in mind in the very last statement, and God seeks what has been driven away. That's a difficult line to interpret, but probably is another way of saying this about history repeating itself. What has been driven away are those things that have taken place in the past and that maybe in some cases people wish would go away. But God seeks it out and He makes sure that those same kinds of things and often difficult things happen over and over again as a way of driving home the truth of His sovereignty and moving us toward Him. And what I want to end with is this, that for God to work this way and to use even the hardships of life for the purpose of getting us to fear Him, that is not cruel. That is actually a gracious thing. That is a gracious act of God. He is moving me through my circumstances to seek ultimate resolution to these things and ultimate satisfaction instead of in things that are going to leave me empty and frustrated in the end. And how do I do that? How is it that I come to fear God and arrange myself under His authority and come to be a part of His kingdom? I do that, the New Testament tells us, through Christ. And it is striking to me as you apply all of this to Christ that here He is, and He went through all these kinds of circumstances Himself, both the good things and the bad things. He submitted Himself to time and the mixed bag of experiences of life in a cursed world. He knew earthly pleasures and even laughter, but He also underwent the kinds of painful experiences that are mentioned here. He was rejected. He was mourned. He mourned. He was killed. He entered into this so that in the end we could be free from this and enter fully into the eternal plan of God and be rightly related to our Creator, being freed from the vapor of life in a world that is cursed by sin. As I thought about this passage, I mentioned the parallel with Romans 8:28, but I was reminded as well of the first chapter of Ephesians, which says all these kinds of things about God doing everything according to the good pleasure of His will, and He has a plan, and He has chosen those of us for faith who are believers, and He is working in time. He worked through Christ. He works through our lives. He's going to take us to glory. And there is this repeated refrain that He does this ultimately to the praise of His glory. And that would be another truth that a passage like Ecclesiastes 3 is driving you to. Don't resist the plan of God, even in cases where it takes you through difficult experiences. You can't see the beginnings of this tapestry, but it is all and has been all eternally determined for the praise of God's glory. And He's given you the privilege of entering into that.